Hello, welcome to Base Camp for Men. I'm your host, Tony Rizak. This is a show that gives you insights and resources in how to live a more courageous life. We look to assist you on your hero's journey in any way that we can. Truth is our compass, humanity, our tribe. Welcome and let's get started. Hello, Base Campers. I hope you're all doing well. There seems to be parallel timelines running right now. On one track is the destruction of the old guard with all the old corrupt systems fueled by endless money printing that debases your purchasing power more and more each and every year with no end in sight. In many ways, the whole system has been plugged into this matrix. You see it everywhere you look. The media reflects it, the healthcare system reflects it, the education system reflects it, and the governments of the world perpetuate it to benefit the oligarchs, institutions, and politicians closest to the money printer. For the rest of us, life is just getting more and more expensive. Then suddenly, Bitcoin entered the story and everything, well, looked different. For those that started storing value in Bitcoin, everything is getting cheaper. Yep, you heard that right. Cars are cheaper, vacations are cheaper, and houses are cheaper. As in, each and every year, things are getting more affordable for Bitcoiners. Kind of mind-blowing, isn't it? Why is that? Well, because there's true scarcity, as in there will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin, even as the adoption curve continues to climb and more companies and nation states hold more and more of it. There's still only ever going to be 21 million. There are some people that have plenty of fiat money and don't care about things getting cheaper. They can afford whatever things are going to cost. But for lots of people around the world, life is too expensive, and this creates an enormous amount of stress. People are losing time because they have to work so hard. Are you following me? Bitcoin allows you freedom. Freedom to work less, freedom to imagine a different future, freedom to enjoy more of your time because costs are coming down for you and your loved ones. It's a compelling argument, isn't it? How will this impact real estate and home ownership? I'm glad you asked. My guest today is a thought leader in the areas of real estate and Bitcoin, one of the only people I know with such an expertise. How will Bitcoin, other than making houses cheaper for you to buy, impact the housing and commercial real estate markets? Let's go have a chat and find out. Enjoy the episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Stand Up Now Apparel. Stand Up Now has amazing designs centered on God, family, freedom, and patriotism. They use only the softest cotton in their designs and have gear for the whole family. There's something for everyone, Base Campers. I know you're going to love their products. Go support them at www.standupnowapparel.com and use the code BASECAMP to receive a 10% discount and free shipping. And now, on to our interview. My guest today is Leon Wankum. Leon is a writer, a soon-to-be author, and a leader at the intersection of Bitcoin and real estate, something we talk at length about today. Leon is active in both real estate and venture capitalist fields and specializes in developing Bitcoin strategies for real estate developers. Here is my interview with Leon Wankum. All right, I am here with Leon Wankum, Bitcoiner, soon-to-be author, and thought leader, Leon Wankum. Leon, welcome to Base Camp for Men. It's great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you know, I heard you on another podcast. I can't remember which one. I know you've been on a number of them. It was really great. I was at the gym working out. I click on quite a few Bitcoin podcasts, as my listeners know, and you were a guest on one, and you were talking about real estate and Bitcoin, and I was like, oh my God, I haven't heard anybody do a take like this. Really interesting, and I just really loved your insight, so I reached out, and thankfully you were game. But I guess before we really get into all of that, I just wanted to ask you, like, where you're at, where you grew up, where you're at in the world, any, you know, family, and what do you do for work?
Sure. Yeah. I grew up in Germany, and I studied out in the UK, actually, and that's why I also encountered Bitcoin. So I studied philosophy and ethics, and then I did a bachelor's also in business management, and then I learned about Bitcoin while studying philosophy, and did my master's in financial economics, and and that's when my Bitcoin journey began, because I wrote my master's thesis about Bitcoin, and then I went back to Germany shortly after. I mean, I've been traveling a little bit after university. I went over to the Middle East. I went to Spain, spent a bit of time in the US. Yep. And when I got back, let's say, back to work, or started working my professional life, and I started working in real estate. And when I was working or when I was working during university, I used to work in the music industry, and I had different touch points with Bitcoin. I had a touch point to Bitcoin in my philosophy degree. I had a touch point with Bitcoin in the nightlife. And I had a touch point with Bitcoin while organizing events, because we were putting on shows back at the time. And then when I went into real estate, I went into real estate development. That's a classic, I'd say, as classic as it can be, meaning it's a company that finds underdeveloped properties, and then it secures financing to develop these properties, develops the properties. So I also got involved in the building process as it is, from acquiring a property up to renting it out, and then also managing the property. And doing that, obviously the scarcity of land, I just thought, you know, it's so obvious that the energy, the effort, and the capital that we're putting into real estate right now is really because we're using it as this investment vehicle. And I thought Bitcoin is a much better investment vehicle. And then you had a few Bitcoiners. The first one that I engaged with that talked about it was Surfer Jim. He wrote an article, I think, comparing Bitcoin to land and then also to real estate. And then it just dawned on me that the most used store of value in the world is real estate. That's the industry I'm involved with. Mm-hmm. Bitcoin was something I got involved with because I was interested in the Austrian School of Economics, and I was interested in the cyberpunk ethos. And it was, you know, I was something that in the music industry people talked about. People talked about Silk Road. People talked about WikiLeaks. Mm-hmm. And I used to like, you know, punk rock, hip hop, counterculture. So that was the narrative that Bitcoin fit in. And then in my corporate identity, I actually understood, wow, Bitcoin is much, much bigger than I thought. It's not going to be this niche internet money for freaks, so to say, for people like me that just think a bit differently than the rest.
Yeah.
This is actually a new monetary standard. And then kind of the story began from there.
So you really came to it from the cypherpunk ethos and music. And that's kind of like, you know, I have heard the origin stories about that kind of culture. So yours wasn't really necessarily through Seyfedean, you know, or a whole bunch of Michael Saylor videos, the way so many of us old guys kind of came across, you know, Breedlove, like clicking on stuff going, what is this technology? Why are people so passionate about it? Yours really came from the old, like where it was really getting started. Were you buying Bitcoin and trading and stuff in the early days, or were you just kind of watching it? Or you know, were you stacking sats way back in the early days of it?
No. I was just watching it. I was just observing it. And I was always the kind of guy who just, I don't know, I just observe and see what people are doing, mm-hmm. and then look for the underlying technology that they're doing it with. And I remember somebody talking in the club. They had a conversation. Oh, how did you buy this? Da 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 da. And then this guy was talking about, oh, I bought it with Bitcoin. And then a few weeks afterwards, I was at a friend's place, and I came from my class, and he was actually online, and he was using Bitcoin to pay for something. And then like eventually, I just observed people using it. I read about it in the news. And then 2013, there was a spike, like the first bull market. Mm-hmm. And the reason for it at the time was that a lot of Europeans wanted to bring money out of Europe. There was a crisis in Cyprus, a financial crisis in Cyprus, if some of you might remember, and they had restrictions on the money. And yep. There were Russians and Chinese investors that wanted to pull their money out of Europe. There were Chinese investors that wanted to pull their money out of China. And then, you know, it really dawned on me that if these large pools of capital are starting to put their money into Bitcoin, I should look into it a bit more. But then I looked at it from the like a perspective of somebody in academia that is almost observing something that is happening. But I wasn't stacking sats at the time.
Yeah.
I was just reading about it a lot, and I totally underestimated it. But I fell in love with the culture. It's strange because it was way, way later when, I mean, Saylor had an effect on me because he definitely allowed me to understand the scope of Bitcoin as digital property.
Mm-hmm.
So also the series with Breedlove that he did, I think it's still one of the best series today. I sometimes still listen to it. And these things had an effect on me as well, but that came later. I didn't even know about these things until 2000, I don't know, 20 or 21. I just learned about Bitcoin, as you said, down in the trenches, so to say, and then over time it grew, but I actually forgot about it for a few years. And then I jumped back into it within my corporate identity, so to say. So everything that you probably heard me saying, that's like me coming back to Bitcoin and now also incorporating it into my day job, so to say.
I'm with you. I fell in love with the culture and just the way Bitcoiners think and frame things. So smart and just optimistic and futuristic. It's really an intoxicating club to be in and to watch and to participate in. I just love it. Especially in this day and age when people are like, what is going on in the world that's good, and it definitely leads. Bitcoin dropped this week. I wanted to address this because it's in the air right now. So it was hovering around 100,000-ish, in the 90s, and then it just kind of the other day it just took a plummet down into the low to mid 80s. Does that concern you? Does that make you feel any certain way? There's some people who just don't even look at price. They're like, that's not why I'm doing this. But you can't help but notice just because if you're clicking on things and it's in your feed, you kind of know what's going on. But I wanted to read you a couple of memes that I thought captured it a little bit and then ask you about, how it makes you feel. So this one's from Bitcoin Sandy. She says, quote, if you stack sats for long-term preservation of purchasing power, but then panic sell when there's a dip for ants, please use pronouns in your email signature. You deserve to be ridiculed at every opportunity, unquote. And then HODL, a guy that I follow, I love on Noster, he says, quote, I have instructed my people to buy lots of Bitcoin if we go to the 80s. Two quick points, though. One, I have no people, and two, I'm also out of money, unquote. So those kind of crack me up and kind of like sometimes I can feel a little bit like, oh God, is this gonna just keep dropping like a stone, yeah, I guess I wanted to ask you about that. Do you pay attention to that? Is that something Saylor doesn't seem to really pay much attention? I mean, he just keeps buying it, right?
I would be lying if I would be saying I don't notice it, of course, and but I don't really care. I've bought, like, I remember actually, now that you're asking, March la of last year, so a year ago, Bitcoin was around 67, and I bought, it dropped to, I don't know, in the 50s, and I bought again. It's like it doesn't really matter because the way that I what if you ask me what is my job, how would I describe my job? I'm the head of Bitcoin strategies within our company. And that means I find ways to buy Bitcoin. One month it might be with rental income. The other month it might be because we can take out a loan against a property. The other month might be because I can take out a loan against an equity portfolio that we incorporated as collateral into a development. So for me, it doesn't really matter. I mean, it's just the question is, what's your goal, right? My goal is to stack BTC within the for the company. So every day and every week and every month, that's what I'm thinking about. And the price I'm buying it at, it's for me, it doesn't really matter. And if we would go further, I'd buy more. But the most important thing is, I mean, don't take out loans against Bitcoin, like these price ranges, basically. Be very prudent with the way you manage your risk. I mean, who am I to tell you what to do? But I think it is important because there are a lot of people that I know that got into Bitcoin early and they just made a stupid mistake because they paid too much attention to the news, which are made up of the fear of other people. Because when we go online, Nostra is different, but even on X or Twitter, it's just everybody is either fearful, greedy, or they are over bullish. And I think it's kind of important to understand that people, generally speaking, are irrational short term, but the market is rational long term. Meaning, when Bitcoin drops like it does now, that's totally irrational because we've got nation states lined up to buy, but I think the reason it is dropping is people heard the news that there might be a strategic Bitcoin reserve. And because of the news, the market was running up. But if you, I think about like somebody like Howard Lutnick, who is going to be in charge, maybe, or it's David Sacks, I'm not familiar with the details, whoever is responsible of making the decision what cryptocurrencies to buy, when, and why, is going to take its time, her time, his time. And these people are professionals, so they're not going to create a scenario where they're pushing up the price. They'd rather push the price down. So you could, you buy 3 Bitcoin, you sell 2, you buy 4 Bitcoin, you sell 2, you buy 5 Bitcoin, you sell 3. Yeah, there's ways of buying an asset without pushing the price up. Yeah. Also, I studied financial economics. I learned about stock trading. I managed equity portfolios of reasonable sizes. And I think it's just important to understand that. And it's going to take time for the US especially to actually buy Bitcoin. And also some, I don't agree with this opinion, but think about it, that most other nation states that don't understand the power play that Trump is basically pulling off right now, the Chinese, they understand it, the Russians, they understand it. There's a few nation states that understand it and they buy Bitcoin, but the others, they don't understand it at all. And it actually makes them not want to buy Bitcoin. So retail at the moment is not interested.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the people that have large pools of money, if they don't sit in the US, in the Emirates, or in some South American country, they have no idea what's going on. We are still actually extremely early.
It's funny, Leon, like the smaller countries of the world, if they had some Bitcoiners in the inner circle, they could really position their country to be unbelievably wealthy and secure and untie the knot to global finance and the IMF and stuff. Like, it could really set themselves up for future generations, right? But they're so precious. They're kind of loyal to the old corrupt system, the old corrupt banking system. So there's like, they're not doing it other than El Salvador. I think there's probably some others that are teed up down in South America as well, because Bukele has a lot of conversations. But yeah, they're it's almost like everybody's waiting for the United States, but they could actually front run the United States to their great benefit. But I don't see anybody really doing that, you know. And then to address something you said earlier, you know, Michael Saylor basically said, look, I'm buying the top of Bitcoin for the rest of my life and for my company. And I think that's a great attitude, because he's not a trader. He's a long-term value investor. And I think if you take that perspective, which is what I do, I'm not a trader. I don't try to time the way that like your equity traders you were talking about buy and sell to squeeze more value and pay less per Bitcoin. I don't think about it that way. I just try to buy each week what I can. And the price is really irrelevant. It's like, okay, here I have a little extra money I made. Let me buy sats today, you know, and that's how I operate. But yeah, you know, you're one of the only people that I know that talks and writes about Bitcoin and real estate. And so it's one of the reasons I reached out. You know, what is the dynamic between these two? And more importantly, you know, how is that going to change over time? Because in America, I live in a very expensive real estate market in America, in Seattle, and people have stored value in their real estate. So boomers, I'm a Gen Xer, many, many, many in these generations bought homes that that were very low priced relative to now at very favorable interest rates, and then watched it as, you know, it went 10x or 5x. And that's where they kind of grew their portfolio. But it definitely feels like the tide is changing. It's gotten more expensive to borrow. Real estate values, at least on the homes here, it feels flat. In fact, even a little saggy. In other words, people are, if they want to get out of their homes, they're not finding a whole long list of buyers like they were even a few years back, right? It's not a hot market. In fact, people are kind of going, well, I'd like to sell, but I don't think right now I can. And then you have this whole younger generation, let's millennials or even my son's generations, Gen Z, they're looking at the real estate market and they're like, I'm never going to be able to buy a house. Like, that it's impossible. They don't know about Bitcoin yet. And so, I mean, that gives you a lot of ways to kind of unpack the real estate Bitcoin market from what you're seeing over in Europe. Is it a similar dynamic? And yeah, just anything you want to talk about as we watch the changing of you know, real estate and equities really were the store of value for a long, long time. Gold too, I guess. But now here comes Bitcoin, and it looks to me like it's changing in real estate, but I wanted to give you a chance to really unpack it. What is changing in this dynamic?
Sure. I think that, first of all, Bitcoin is taking the monetary premium, meaning the money that's invested into asset classes, because fiat money is a bad store of value. It's taking up the monetary premium that sits in various asset classes. So you mentioned gold, real estate, art, possibly other collectibles, like, I don't know, cars. So we don't know. Everything that's built up a monetary premium, yep. Wine has done to some sort, whiskey. There's actually like quite a variety of asset classes in the fiat system that have taken on the role of being a store of value, which is actually a function of money. So good money should retain value over time and space, because otherwise, who's going to accept that money? We've kind of forgot about that, I'd say, natural dynamic, natural law, because we've been so accustomed to, or we've become used to, using the money that we are paying our taxes in. But thinking about money as the thing that you're paying your taxes in is actually, it's kind of like, if you really think about it, it's strange that we are living in a time we would be thinking we'd be more like on a higher conscious frequency, but we still, the tool that we use day to day to sell goods and services, to trade, to value each other. Because think about it, if I buy a product of you and I pay you in the money, the currency I'm paying you in, it's kind of a sign of, like, what do I think is your time worth? And if I give you money that's losing value, that has a bad taste to it.
Yeah.
So I think, right? So I think overall, so we think about Bitcoin being different. It's sound money. And then you look at real estate and you say, okay, what was real estate worth before 1971 when the US cut the standard, or any standard that the dollar had?
Mm-hmm.
And you can say in the 40s, 50s, it was around $4,000. And today it's around $500,000. You can really see that even though technology has allowed us to have a higher standard of living, and you know, in Seattle, there's a few companies, some of which I think contributed towards the good of humanity, and some that have worked counter the greater good of humanity. But it doesn't matter, because technology has allowed us to raise our standard of living. But because inflation has been so high, it has masked the gains in efficiency of production, and things have become more expensive with inflation. And housing has become so extremely expensive, because if you think about it, it's actually so important in the fiat system, because it's the basic collateral that exists in the fiat system and the financial system, next to equities, next to debt markets, to bonds, actually sits on real estate. So banks have an interest to consistently create new money, funnel it into real estate developments in order to raise the nominal value of the collateral they themselves use to lend against, to fund themselves, because everybody works on debt. So this now has created a system where housing, which is actually has a utility value because we live in it, mm-hmm. now has become a financial asset. And because Bitcoin is scarcer, it will absorb the money, I think, over time that people invest in real estate. And then over time, as that happens, real estate or housing can become more affordable. And if you hold Bitcoin, it's obvious that housing becomes affordable, like, very fast, because yep. Bitcoin is so fast. And I think we could stop there and just say, you know, Bitcoin is going to stripe the monetary premium out of real estate, or there's a good video where Saylor talks about property, and he basically destroys the investment thesis behind building wealth in real estate. But I think we can go a step further and we say, now we understand this is actually going to happen, and it's actually already happening because you, me, everybody who holds Bitcoin, we can see how fast real estate is getting more affordable for us. Mm-hmm. But then the question is, if this is happening on a large scale, what is that going to do to architecture? What is going to do to the way that we live, to community? Will it allow us to afford, you know, larger living spaces? Because one of the highest forms of stress that you can have as a human being, and this is proven, there's a hierarchy that shows it, and you talk to any psychologist, if you don't have shelter, right? It's very obvious. If you don't have shelter, you feel shit. And it's actually something that's in the back of most people's mind, is that they're not able to afford living conditions they feel comfortable in. And this then has second order effects, and it creates trauma. And if we now go into because I did like that you had this little intention that we set at the beginning. And if you ask me, you know, what is my intention? I think my intention is really to help people understand that you need to hold Bitcoin if you want something to change in your life, because the system is not going to change and nobody's coming to help you. So you need to own Bitcoin. And that's why I always talk about Bitcoin being digital real estate, because most people that do not own Bitcoin, they want to build wealth through real estate. And that just doesn't make sense, because we are at the end of a debt cycle. Like you said, the reason why real estate continuously went up in price since 1971 and then also since 2008 was because the global financial system was constantly on the brink of collapse. And since 82, with falling interest rates, money was consistently funneled into the system to create growth, because growth in the fiat system is based on debt and arbitrage opportunities. But we are not just at the end of a debt cycle now, we are also at a paradigm shift in the way that we actually want to store value, because we're now moving away from tangible objects into digital goods. And it all started with the internet and the digitalization of information. And now Bitcoin is going to a step further. It's digitalizing capital, or digitalizing value. And I think also for the human consciousness to, you know, it takes a bit of time for, I'd say, like, humanity to understand that it is better to store value in a digital currency rather than in the tangible good. But over time, more people will understand it. And in 50 years' time or 100 years' time, this will be common knowledge. And people will probably look back at this conversation and they'll just laugh that people were so, I don't know, maybe ignorant or so tied up in the matrix that they couldn't see it. And sometimes when you look at pictures, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but have you ever seen pictures, early pictures of people sitting on a car and then they're having two horses pulling the car? You know, people don't, that's, it's like, I think it's a good example to show that if a technology doesn't fit into the existing framework or mind or way of thinking, it just takes time for humanity to adjust its way of thinking to this new technology.
Do you think that, okay, let's say you're doing I'm going to buy a house. I'm looking to move, and Bitcoin has done really well, a real estate developer is looking, like, do you think people will, I'll pay, you know, it's just an ordinary person, I've got enough Bitcoin to buy, you know, these houses, this house that I want to live in. Oh, we found something that we really like. Do you think I will be paying directly with Bitcoin, or do you think that there's going to be financial services that grow up and there'll be an approach that becomes the dominant approach where I say, well, I have X amount of Bitcoin and I want that house and I don't have to. I mean, will the borrowing continue, or are we going to get away from fiat borrowing? There's a lot of factors. I don't know what they're going to do. They've printed money so much that they're stuck. Like, they can either keep printing, they could try to repeg it to Bitcoin and gold. I don't know, you know, Trump is surrounded by Bitcoiners. And so I'm very interested to see what happens with this. But yeah, do you think 5 years from now, 10 years from now, I know there's a lot of changing factors, but will I be buying a house with directly with Bitcoin and like, you know, flashing, there you go, I just paid for the house without borrowing any money? Or do you not think that will be good for Bitcoin, is it'll be better to hold it and have a different way of paying for it?
Yeah, I think debt-based system won't go away. I always have 50 years in my mind. I don't know why.
Yeah.
But if you ask me how long is the dollar going to continue, I'd say at least 50 years.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm over-exaggerating, but I'll tell you why. Because it's true, Bitcoin has infiltrated the circles of Trump, or Trump has Bitcoiners that he's working with, but you can see they don't understand Bitcoin. I think what he has understood is that Bitcoin is growing faster in market price than the interest on the outstanding debt. So Bitcoin now has become a way for the US to extend the fiat system, similar to how Richard Nixon in 1974. So 3 years after the Nixon shock, he traveled to Saudi Arabia and he met with King Faisal. And they agreed that all the oil-producing countries would sell their oil against dollars. And that created demand for the dollar. Mm-hmm. And that kept the dollar-based system afloat. And over the past 3 to 4 years, the existing dollar-based petrol system actually obviously changed. Russia started to sell in rubles. China started to sell in yen. And different currencies were used for oil trading. But I think now what is happening is that through Tether, there's going to be a dollarization of the world. People are going to start to use the dollar because, think about it, most people don't save. Like, I'm talking about the people that earn like $1 a day, $2 a day, the people that actually could benefit from Bitcoin. They don't really save yet and they use Tether. It doesn't really matter what you think about Tether. That's just really the way it is. And Bitcoin is going to exist alongside the dollar. And maybe in 50 or 60 years' time, Bitcoin is going to be a $100 trillion asset. And then, you know, the US government will say, you know what, we'll erase the debt, or we'll start a new dollar that is backed by Bitcoin. That could actually also start this year or next year, where the US might issue bonds and they'll say, we have 2% of the bond in Bitcoin, we have 5% of the bond in Bitcoin. And as Bitcoin monetizes over time, they'll need to add more and more Bitcoin into the bond, because why would you buy a bond if it's not Bitcoin based? If people understand they can better save their purchasing power with buying Bitcoin rather than buying a bond. So I think that bonds and Bitcoin will merge over time until people won't accept anything else than Bitcoin, but it's going to take a very, very long time. And now you will ask me, how can people buy real estate? I'm happy, or I'd like to hear what you think about what I just said. But I just want to add on that you could also, because the fiat system won't go away, you can personally decide how you would like to purchase your house. If you don't want to participate in the fiat system, you can pay with Bitcoin. You can pay directly. But I think what's going to happen, there's an incentive to spend fiat currency, not Bitcoin, as long as Bitcoin is increasing in purchasing power faster than fiat debt. So people can actually lend against the Bitcoin, buy a house, and as Bitcoin grows in purchasing power, they could even take out the loan when they, like, imagine you want to buy a house that's worth $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
If you take out a loan that is $1 million and $100,000, you could actually buy the building for $1 million. You buy Bitcoin for 100,000, and every year you peel off a little bit of the Bitcoin, you pay back the interest rate, so then it becomes a self-paying mortgage.
Mm.
And there's CJ Constantinos, who's building a product called, I think, the People's Reserves, where he is allowing you to take out money against your Bitcoin to buy real estate, but you can take out a bit more, buy Bitcoin, and then it becomes a self-paying mortgage. And that actually uses the dynamic of Bitcoin increasing in purchasing power because of inflation, and allows you then to pay down your mortgage over time and actually own your house after a decade, which is faster than waiting 2 decades.
Right. Yeah, so that's fantastic. I like that you brought up that it's, you know, I think there's a tendency to think that it's happening faster than it is. It's people are becoming aware, consciousness is happening, people are attracted to Bitcoin, or they're hearing about it now fourth or fifth time, so they're starting to take a look at it. But you're right. The US will do whatever it can to preserve the United States dollar, preeminence, even as BRIC nations are starting to get away from it. There's a new sheriff in town. Let's see how that plays out. But yeah, it's like when you say I take a 50-year view, I'm like, oh, that's really smart, right? It's probably not. These are really big, asset classes, and it doesn't happen overnight. It takes a long time for something to shift and move, and for it to gain a tipping point where everybody sort of understands what we've been talking about. I wanted to ask you specifically, though. You had written, I read in your blog that you had said that fiat stifles innovation, and that Bitcoin and Nostr have the potential to unlock innovation. And I was curious about that. I think a lot of people would say, well, how is it doesn't seem like innovation is being stifled. Like, we've had all these different things that have come now. Many of these have come from what looks like oligarchs and highly funded government, business people, let's say. But how do you see Bitcoin and Nostr unlocking maybe new avenues of innovation that weren't there before, let's say?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I believe it's one of the biggest lies that's being sold to the general public that innovation needs a government funding, because it's the lie that the government and the creation of money is needed to create wealth. Fiat money existed for thousands of years. You had fiat money in China. Marco Polo, he traveled to China, and I think the 14th century, if I'm not mistaken, he actually learned about fiat money in China. The Chinese used paper currencies for a long time. And the grandson of Genghis Khan, Kublai Khan, he founded a dynasty that was huge, because the Mongols also took over China. But the dynasty fell apart eventually because they created paper currency. So, and I can also give a case of the Romans that inflated the gold back currency called aureus that they used in the 2nd and 3rd century after ante deus, and that also over time led to social unrest because of inflation and things. Like, if you would not have a fiat-based standard, things would be so extremely cheap, and people would have so much time that people would have more capital and more time to come up with solutions to real world problems. And I think if you guys would see what's happening in Germany, you would lose your mind. Germany is one of the most innovative countries in the world. You have engineers. A lot of the people were murdered, obviously, by the National Socialists that were particularly innovative, because they hated intellectuals and they hated certain minorities that had a high grade of education. They demonized these people as capitalists, globalists, blah, blah, blah. And they started killing all these people. So the German-based society also now turned into a very jealous-based society. People are very, like, if you're successful, if you're wealthy, people are very jealous. But if you're a good human being, people really like that. So the consequence of that was, now, if you want to be an entrepreneur in Germany, it's not about solving a real-world problem. It's about, for example, creating a company that doesn't waste energy or that is not energy intensive. And then you get hundreds of millions. And if you go through the countryside in Germany, you see all these wind parks where hundreds of millions were funneled into, because this was sold as the greatest innovation. But that was a lie. And the people that got involved with that business and that received all the subsidies, I don't think these people were innovative entrepreneurs. They just understood how to get these subsidies. So, looking at the wind parks in Germany and the inefficiency of generating wind energy really shows you that wherever the government places importance and where they funnel money into is not the industry that actually needs that money. It's the industry where certain people or key players in the government can actually also earn money with, because they control the industry. But the real problems are, like, who funded Satoshi Nakamoto? Nobody. He came up with Bitcoin by himself, not because he received funding or they received funding. It's because these people had the time to think about a problem and then find a solution for that problem. And it doesn't necessarily need funding to be innovative, but if you want to scale that innovation, you need money. And in the past, if you wanted money, you needed money from the government or you went to a VC fund. But most of the VC funds in Europe especially, but also in the US, they are controlled by the government because they are also being subsidized by the government. So, but now we have a currency which is called Bitcoin, which is a hard currency, sound money that people can use. They can save in that currency and they can sell, they can find the time to solve problems. And there are people in the Bitcoin community, somebody I really admire, Ahmed Apaman, he comes up, he builds nodes and this and that. And you can really see how this guy, being a Bitcoiner, finds time because Bitcoin allows him to not most likely work 24/7 and then come up with all these solutions to problems. And one of the examples I always give, the Wright brothers, who came up with flying in 1903. They had a bicycle shop and they were saving in gold, and that basically allowed them to save up so much money that they came up with flying. And then look at Nicolaus Otto, who came up with the combustion engine. Mm-hmm. He didn't need funding from anybody else. It cost a few thousand Deutschmark at the time. Look at Benz, the car, Mercedes.
Mm-hmm.
Funding of the company was not funded by institutionalized capital. These were entrepreneurs that just saved, and because they had a gold standard, they had so much time and the capital to put their ideas into reality. And right now we have an obscure idea of how innovation works because inflation has made things so expensive that you need so much money that you need the government to then fund. And you can see it within the space race right now. Yeah. I think one of the most next to Bitcoin and AI, one of the most interesting fields is space,
yeah.
Because I mean, space technology has lots of benefits also for Earth, but it has become so expensive to fund a space company. It costs hundreds of millions and billions that you need government funding, and that is a way for governments to also exercise control in certain industries. And look at the banking industry; it's not innovative at all. And any innovation, for example, Bitcoin, is just being fought. And then universities that are just actually part of the government because they're government funded, they just bash Bitcoin. Now it's changed because Bitcoin has become so successful. But think about all the technologies we never learned about because the government didn't want us to learn about the technology. Think about the knowledge we never learned about because nobody mm-hmm. wanted us to know about that knowledge. It's actually totally crazy. And it's not just the case that this has been the case for the last hundreds of years. For thousands of years, humanity has gone through cycles. We've become enlightened beings. And then we went through these dark, dark, dark ages. And you can even see the Middle Ages, the Dark Ages, they're called the Dark Ages because we've lost a lot of the knowledge that we had because the church at the time, I went to Catholic school and I have a lot of respect for religion and also for the Christian religion. I'm talking about now the institutions back then, the politicians.
Yep, for sure.
They captured the religion mm-hmm. and they burned a lot of the books, and people for hundreds of years were actually not aware. They were kept actually as mental slaves. And now we're breaking through the cycle again, where a lot of the knowledge we don't know about has now, through the internet, has reached humanity's consciousness. And now we have a currency that allows us to to collaborate because we can pay each other. And now I want to talk about Nostra, because think about the importance of communication. Every totalitarian regime wants to shut down the internet. And you can also see I don't know if you really read the Twitter files. I actually sit down for a few days. And Elon, after purchasing Twitter, he just published all the emails that were going back and forth between the Biden and Harris administration and Twitter employees. And I was shocked by the level of I think it was almost like a dictatorship. I mean, it was totally crazy, at least in my eyes. People were actually told what to do. Political opponents were silenced. People were forced to delete profiles of activists and political opponents people didn't agree with. And that really shows you it's so important that we have protocols for communications that can't be shut down. And so sound money, the ability to save, which gives us time and independence, that's level number one. Level number two is Nostra, the ability to communicate freely. And now level number three is applications that sit on Nostra that make use of Bitcoin and Lightning as the payment infrastructure. And I think that's going to develop now over the next decades, and we can see the innings of it. We can see podcasts, Bitcoin-based podcasts, value for value payments, Lightning-based savings technologies. I mean, sometimes, we want Bitcoin to go up in price, but we fail to see what is happening around us. Bitcoinization is actually happening as we speak.
Yeah, absolutely. You said a lot there. I'm interested in your thoughts on what you had just said. Is it resonates so much? It's almost like this awakening in humanity, and it's not just here in the States or over in Europe. It's all over the place. People are becoming aware that, we got lulled to sleep. You and I, before we got on air, we were talking about education in Germany and education in the United States. And I said, we basically took a page from your education system, is our public schools. And it just became more and more obvious. When I went to public schools, there was a lot of pride in being American. We did the Pledge of Allegiance. We learned all the great things that Americans did, and learned about our entrepreneur history, and just all the great American heroes, and the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, all these things. They don't get that anymore. And you were speaking about how in Germany, they're so they just have beat them over the head with the Nazi thing so much that you can't even stand up and say that you're proud to be German or proud to be white in my country now. Not anymore. The tide is shifting, but for a long time they were teaching the kids, and doing it in a way where the parents can't really see what the curriculum is because they're not allowed in to look at the curriculum. There's this kind of subtle racism that all white people are racist. We're not going to teach about the Declaration of Independence and all the great things that Americans do. We're going to go back and say that all Americans are born out of white supremacy and slavery, right? Even though most of the kids in the classroom up the street, their parents did not own slaves, but they're using Marxist techniques to create a bent over population that can't stand up for itself. You said you see it in Germany. I think there needs to be a reclamation of decentralized knowledge, to your point earlier, that there's a problem in centralization. Look at what's happening right now in the United States government. Every day they go, look at the scam, look at how they've stolen our value. There's corruption everywhere. And the centralized education is corrupt. They're not learning anything good. In fact, if people really understood what the kids were learning, they would get them out of there even faster than they're taking them out, which is rapidly right now because people are becoming aware, you know what? I don't want my kid confused whether he's a boy or a girl. But that's what they're getting in schools right now. And so we're seeing how rotten the corrupt deep state, cabal, globalist, however you want to phrase it, centralized control, whether it's Google and Microsoft, medicine, centralized, insurance, it's all a big Ponzi scheme to keep people in the dark and feeding on lies that we need the centralized control. Otherwise, what would we do without the centralized control? It's like, well, why don't we find out? We're already building decentralized systems. Bitcoin, brilliant decentralized system for money and store of value and exchange. Nostr, a brilliant decentralized social media where we can communicate and they can't shut it down. And I think it's just the start. I think we're going to see more and more of this decentralized revolution that Bitcoin is leading. Nostr is another example of how exciting it is, but I think you're going to see it pop up all over the place as people learn in their own time, oh, the government did not really view us as they don't like us. They feed off of us, but people have been so, to your point earlier, where you said it's virtue signaling and being a quote unquote nice person is paramount more than the truth, more than freedom, more than your future generations being empowered. And once people realize that in their own timeline, I think it's coming. I think Trump is a wrecking ball to the centralized system right now, and I'm loving it. But I think people are going to start to look over in the decentralized camps that are growing, and they're going to realize, you know what? That looks way better. Those people are way more optimistic. They're solution-oriented. They're entrepreneurs in their own right. And it's also the beautiful thing about the decentralized revolution is it's giving the middle finger, two middle fingers, to the centralized system that has enslaved us. So that's a lot back at you, but I wanted to do my little riff because I'm super excited about what's being created. Even though I don't, like, if you and I were to have this conversation 10, 15 years from now, we might be like, oh my God, can you believe what got created that we didn't even know or hadn't even been birthed in the minds of anybody yet?
Yeah, no, it's pretty cool. I like it as well. I find it interesting. I watch from the sidelines. I'm actually also happy that people, because sometimes it's so frustrating. You talk with people and you tell them, listen, for example, most of the aid that's being sent out in the world, yes, of course, it's a good idea. And also, if you look at Rothbard believed that reparations were something useful. For example, if I did something bad to you, punishment could have been reparations. But there needs to be a point where you say reparations have been paid, because otherwise it becomes a scheme.
Yep.
And that is what has happened. So I think it started with the right idea, because at some point you need to say, okay, maybe we pay reparations for something that has happened. And I think you need to also own up to the British for being the first ones to actually do it, because the word slave, where does it come from? It comes from people, Slavs from Northern Europe, that were enslaved by Northern Africans, and they were brought down to Cartago and other places. So slavery has existed throughout humanity. And in Germany, it existed 80 years ago. So some minorities were enslaved in Germany. Mm-hmm. So paying reparations, either in the form of, you know, paying money or whatever, and being willing to do that, I think that in itself is something that actually I think we can be thankful for to the British and also to the Germans. And then there's a point where you need to say, okay, now we have to also understand what has this turned into. Yep. And when you look into the world, for example, US aid, some people think, wow, they're cutting resources to help the most vulnerable. But actually what has happened is the resources meant for the most vulnerable, they have been captured by terrorist organizations, traitors, just criminals, dictators, and it's been feeding this system, this global system of exploitation. Yep. And you don't help, you just actually feed the system. And people have, I've been getting messages more recently by friends of mine who just called myself, of course, a conspiracy theorist for all the time when I told them, you know, read about, you know, what these people are also publishing, read about some of these texts that have been published and the way that NGOs want to alter the way that we understand law. And that has been tried for hundreds of years. Karl Marx was basically not the first one to come up with ideas that are totally irrational and based on a utopian perception of egoists that want everybody to think like they think. And for some reason, socialism has grabbed human consciousness again, and now in the form of aid, for example. And it's good that the swamp is being drained. Yeah. And I think it also serves as a lesson for other countries, because people can say about the US whatever they want. Even for the enemies, it's a role model. Even the enemies of the US, even they look to the US in terms of what are they doing? What is the, how is the law structured? What is the financial base in the US? You know, you guys, you set the tone.
Mm-hmm.
So now you guys are helping the world, I think, to understand the corruption within government. Not saying that I think the end game of this, we should have a government that's totally decentralized, because the government in itself right now, it's still very centralized, of course, but you have to start somewhere. You have to make people aware of the grand scheme of things that we're living. It's scam after scam. Insurance is a scam. Fiat system is a scam. Medicine is a scam. Schooling is a scam. I mean, so much for people to realize. It's tough. It's going to take time.
I know. I mean, it's you and I and people that think like us, you know, we've got name called a lot, but I don't know about you, but I feel very calm. Like I find it very fascinating the speed at which things are happening right now. And I'm grateful. And I'm grateful for the decades I spent looking at globalism and looking at things like the World Economic Forum and how money was being spent and getting into all the rabbit holes, because I feel like I've got a pretty good, you know, it's incomplete. It's not like there's never an aha, but I did all the work. I did the proof of work in understanding what might be behind power and started to realize that what they were telling us was not the truth or were half truths or were just flat out lies. And, you know, what's interesting too is in this country, I'm sure it's probably the same kind of dynamic in Germany and Europe, is they've created so many dependents on the state that people will fight for the matrix, because it's so scary to think of not having that, either the safety net or the government job, or they don't like this talk that you and I are having because they don't know what's on the other side. And so they're very protective of the status quo, even though if they took some time to look at it, they would realize, holy shit, I've been really enslaved and I've been really conditioned to protect structures that are not really good for humanity. But because I get my check in the form of, you know, it could be a disability check or it could be just a government, you work at a government job. So they're very loyal. They've done a great job of creating loyalty to socialism. And it runs completely counter in this country to what the founding fathers stood for and what a lot of Americans feel. But there's definitely that kind of dynamic of pro-socialism, pro-Marxism. So I don't know what you want to say. We're almost out of time, and I definitely want to give you a chance to talk about the upcoming book and where listeners can find you. But I just wanted to give you a chance to reflect on kind of loyalty to socialism, I guess.
Yeah, I actually grew up, I grew up around socialism because I had parts of my family were socialist, and they were actually persecuted also by the Nazis. And but then I realized, well, actually, they are also collectivists. So I started to understand that there's different levels of socialism. There is communism, so there's Marxism in its root. Then you have communism, then you have national socialism, who were inspired by the fascists. So Hitler was a big fan of Il Duce, of Mussolini, who was a fascist. Yep. He started out as a socialist. Then he became a fascist because he wanted to be a bit more aggressive. And Hitler was also a fascist. And I always thought, oh, we are socialists. We are the enemies of the National Socialist. We are good. And then I understood, wow, fuck, we are collectivists as well. Yep. And I was around like 13, 12, I mean, I also had obviously large side of my family were capitalists, but I had like an uncle and so forth who were socialist, and I identified with their narrative because as an adolescent, I was a 10 or 11 year old, I was like, oh yeah, we should fight, you know, for the vulnerable. I was interested in the revolution in Cuba. I was reading about Che Guevara, and these guys, they had a way in portraying these people as heroes, and it got to my mind as a 10 or 11 or 12 year old. But around 13, 14, that's where I switched my mind and where it changed. So I do understand why socialism takes people control of people's mind. And then I had a teacher in school. So I went to Catholic school, but even in Catholic school, I'd say 50% of my teachers were socialist, Marxist, communist. And I had a teacher that was teaching I think biology or maths, and she would wear a t-shirt with a picture of Mao. And I'd tell her, look, Mao is a mass murderer and he killed more people than Adolf Hitler. I'm not saying Adolf Hitler is not a mass murderer. I'm just saying there were many different forms of collectivists. And she told me, you know, I don't want you to talk like that. Next time you talk like that, you need to leave class. And I was like, this is insane.
Yep.
Teachers are literally teaching the children that socialism is good. And then people start to believe that you need to be a socialist in order to be anti-Nazi. Because yes, the socialists were fighting with the Nazis, but there were rivalry. There was a rivalry which collectivist idea would win. And now that one collectivist idea lost doesn't mean that the other collectivist idea is good. And I think the other collectivist idea, which is socialism, that is still, I think, and I think it's still an ongoing theme in German education. And that is the big problem. It's so deeply rooted into our education system, because I was sold the idea that being a socialist means you are anti-Nazi. But I now understood it basically means you're a collectivist as well. And individual freedom has now become, I think, like the Austrian School of Economics and finding individual freedom to Bitcoin agorism, building a new system. That has now become my focus, but it's going to take decades until, I'm talking about the German people now, until the German people understand that any type of collectivist thinking is bad. It's not good if you're socialist because you're anti-Nazi. Both the socialist and the national socialist, they were part of collectivism. And Hayek and Ayn Rand and other people, they know they were drumming or banging the drums on this for so long. And it's taking me 15 years to really understand the complexity of this issue. And it has helped to grow up in Germany and have a background where also part of my family immigrated into Germany. So I've seen, you know, I've seen it from the face of an immigrant and also from a German, a socialist, capitalist. I've had all these different viewpoints in my life, and I've been able to connect some dots, but I've not been able to connect all the dots. And I think it's also important to understand, just because we've understood that now there's a new system called Bitcoin, it's not that we've understood everything, right? I mean, there's so much information that we don't have. So I just try to sometimes not even make sense of it all, but put my energy into Bitcoin.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah, we have some of the same dynamics here. It's all, they're all the universities are teaching, all the teachers are being taught how to be social justice warriors, virtue signal, be collectivists. I mean, it's what's in our schools right now. It's why so many parents are getting them out of the public schools, because they see how much they're being indoctrinated. And so, yeah, there's we're going to see a revolution, I believe, here in this country in education, as they start to take a look at the Department of Education and what's been going on, which I am very, very much looking forward to watching and commenting on. So you have a book coming out hopefully this summer called Digital Real Estate. Leon, where can people find you and your writing? When is the book coming out? I know you probably don't have an exact date quite picked out. And then where can people find the book?
Sure. I have like September in mind, and yeah, as things go, it's probably going to be October, November. Mm-hmm. I want to be finished by summer and then take a month or two for editing and finding a right cover, because I have a few in mind. The book is called Digital Real Estate, and it's really a collection of the articles that I wrote specifically on Bitcoin and real estate, the investment thesis that exists today around real estate. I think that investment thesis can be applied to Bitcoin. You used to buy real estate back in the day to participate in the, let's take Manhattan, because that's an example that's so frequently used. And I read a tweet by Stackholder that I bookmarked from 2021 today again. And I remember reading that tweet back then, and the tweet was somewhere along the lines of 1981, you'd buy a property in Manhattan and you would participate in the value increase of the financial district, and the international demand for property in Manhattan, 2021, you buy Bitcoin, the scarcest assets in the world. You participate in the value increase of the Bitcoin network and the global demand for the Bitcoin network. So that's the value thesis behind Bitcoin being digital real estate, meaning it's the most pristine form of being a store of value and collateral. And then I have different strategies that are worked out for real estate developers. I go actually into detail and I implemented these strategies myself where I could. And then I go into the last and the final chapter that I'm writing right now. And that's actually most fun for me. I go into the secondary effects of Bitcoin being the new hurdle rate. How is housing going to be affordable? How is Bitcoin going to change the building environment? What does Bitcoin urbanism look like? What is sound architecture? How is Bitcoin gonna change the way that people invest? If they don't need to invest to outperform inflation, what is that going to do to innovation, to investments, interest rates, and the overall standard of living? And the book is going to have like 200 pages, I think.
Beautiful. Well, Leon, thanks so much for coming on Basecamp for Men and sharing your insight and your wisdom. Super great to chat with you. I was looking forward to this for the last few weeks, and you didn't disappoint. It's really great. You've got a really interesting take on a whole bunch of things that we're interested in. So come back anytime, and we'll be anxiously awaiting the book. I'll be first to be clicking on buy when it comes out. So please let us know when it's released.
Yeah, I'd be happy to chat again, and I'll let you know. And I'll actually take a note now to send you one of those.
Okay, beautiful. Thank you, Leon.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you around the fire next week. If you find value in our show and wish to show us some love, we are now making that very easy to do. You simply go to www.basecampformen.com and click on Donate Support Basecamp. You'll find an easy way to make either monthly donations for as little as $5 a month, or you can donate just once. We love the monthly donation and hope to build this up over the coming months, but any show of support is greatly appreciated, honestly. Thank you for your support and for helping to keep Basecamp as a resource on your hero's journey. That's our show for today. Thank you for listening. Men, good luck in all your endeavors and good luck on your hero's journey. This is Tony Rezac, and you're listening to Basecamp for Men.